Hi and welcome. This is Dutch the Podcast. I can prove it to you because there's the guy right there from Dutch the Media himself, the executive producer of this show and Dutch the Magazine, Tom Byfoot. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
Doing great. Okay, now look, subscribe to this show, tell a friend, more info on that at the end of the show. We have a great interview coming up. After that, we'll give you some insights about what else you can find from Dutch the Media. Tom, who are we speaking with today?
So we're speaking to Boudewijn van Oort. He lives in Victoria, British Columbia, and he is a survivor of the internment camps during World War II in Indonesia, used to be the Dutch East Indies. So quickly, by way of background, when the Japanese invaded the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, there were a lot of Dutch people living there, and the Japanese rounded them all up and put them in civilian internment camps. And young Boudewijn was only 3 years old when that happened. So really, he had no memories of before the camp. And it really affected his life for the rest of his life. I don't want to tell his story on his behalf. He is very capable of doing that himself. So maybe we should start by listening to Boudewijn's experiences.
All right, here we go with that.
Welcome, Boudewijn van Oort, who is joining us on this episode of Dutch the Podcast. And I'm really very happy to welcome you, Boudewijn.
Thank you. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Boudewijn. It's great to see each other in person. It's been a long time. We met in person in Penticton many, many years ago, but it's been a while since we've seen each other face to face.
Yeah, that's good fun.
So anyway, what we want to talk about today, you recently published an article in a Dutch anthropological, or I believe a Flemish anthropological journal, and we'll be talking about tough subject, really, I think, to talk about, and I think it's very great that you're willing to talk about it. We're going to be talking about the internment camps in the former Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, where Dutch civilians were locked up, concentrated during World War II. So maybe, Boudewijn, we can start with a brief historical overview of what happened. Why did you end up, because clearly you're one of the survivors of those camps, why did you end up in a camp, and what were those camps all about?
First of all, why I ended up in Indonesia was by accident. My father decided to immigrate to Indonesia at a bad time. That's in 1940, shortly after the Dutch capitulation. We were living in South Africa. Why did the war start in Indonesia? Japan got itself into a pickle, and it needed secure access to raw materials, which Indonesia had in plenty. And so in 1941, when Germany invaded Russia, Japan felt secure enough to ignore Russia and to launch a war of aggression in order to gain complete control over the resources of Indonesia, which is first and foremost oil. They needed oil to help them fight the war in China. And then on top of that, Indonesia also had bauxite and tin. And anyway, it was a fabulously wealthy country. And Indonesia was at that stage a colony without a protector, because Holland had ceased to exist. It was a plum ready for picking.
Yes, Holland had been occupied by the Germans already, so the Dutch government in exile did not have an army or anything like that, so they couldn't defend the Indonesian colony.
Yeah, even at the best of times, Indonesia would be impossible to defend. But the big defender was, of course, the potential defender was the United States. And but the Japanese thought that by bombing the hell out of Pearl Harbor, they could effectively remove the United States as a player in the game and therefore gain access to Indonesia, which they did within a remarkably short time of 90 days.
Wow. And it's a huge country, right? Let's be clear. It's thousands of islands, huge.
The distances were phenomenal. Nobody could understand how the Japanese could do such an audacious thing. And of course, so that's how the war started. And the war ended with the atom bomb. But once the Japanese had control of Indonesia, they had a political problem. And the political problem was the unwelcome presence of a large European community. And in that process, all Europeans were interned, concentrated, and removed from basically from sight from the Indonesians or from the remaining Asian people there. It was, in fact, ethnic cleansing on the grand scale.
So you lived there. How old were you? You were 5 years old?
I arrived when I was in my second year, and I was interned. My father was interned when I turned 3 and a half, and my mother and I were interned a couple of months later. So I was about in my fourth year as we went into the prison camp, and I celebrated my seventh birthday 1 week after the official Japanese capitulation of the 15th of August. But at that time, I knew nothing about that.
No, of course not. And you were a very young child. So really, I presume that your first memories are from in the camp and not any time prior to that. Is that correct?
No, I have memories from before the camp and a couple of nice things that happened, you know, birthdays. I have memories of entering the camp, which are quite remarkable. But then we ended up in an extremely boring lifestyle. Nothing happened. So I have very few memories from 1944, 1944. My memories flashed on the 10th of May, 1945, when we were transported from Bandung to Jakarta. And it was a horrible journey. And it is as though I had a memory recorder that all of a sudden was switched on. And so I have pretty clear memories of those months after the 10th of May, 1945.
Now, can we talk briefly about life in the camps, maybe not even from your own memory, but from what you've heard or researched from others? What were these internment camps like? To begin with, you explained that the men and the women were separated into different camps, and then the children, boys up to the age of 11, were allowed to stay with their mothers, but then afterwards they would be sent to separate camps. But what was life like in these camps?
Boring. There's nothing to do. Our life revolved around, we slept at night, we tried to sleep. Food, always waiting for food. There was never enough food. And then particularly under the Japanese military regime, which only started in about the middle of 1944, we were treated as formal prisoners of war and had to be counted every day. We had lists of names, and we every day, three times a day, we had to be lined up to be counted to make sure that all prisoners were present and accounted for. So aside from being counted, aside from waiting for food and trying to sleep at night in horribly overcrowded conditions, there was nothing to do. No school.
That's what I was going to ask. In particular, you were there when any normal child would be going to school, learning how to read, learning arithmetic. How did that, was that possible even, or it didn't happen at all?
During the initial stages, the women, I was in the women's camp, of course, the women tried to regain within the confines of the camp, they tried to regain something resembling normal Western civil life. So they have church services and have some form of justice system, and also had to school. But the resources were extremely limited, and with time, that was all forbidden. So I spent 2 or 3 days at school in kindergarten, and then 2 or 3 days with the nuns, and that was the end of it. And And as the Japanese tried to bring all the Europeans that had been scattered over these islands into a closer and smaller group so that it could be easily guarded, we were basically robbed of all our possessions. And I had, at the end of the war, I owned one thing, and that was the silly clothes I wore, something my mom had made. I had nothing else. And
no toys, teddy bears, no nothing.
Yeah, we were the books were taken away, everything was taken away, and my sole possession was the pair of pants I could wear, and my mom had a couple of spoons and a couple of bowls that we used for eating, and I didn't even have a place in daytime to sleep. I only had a place at nighttime to sleep.
And you were 7 years old when the capitulation, the Japanese capitulated. So you were really young when this all started. Now, you also hear, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, but you hear about the atrocities in the camps some severe things happened, high mortality rate. Is that something that you were exposed to as well?
Potentially, I was exposed to my mom being beaten, badly beaten. That never happened. But other kids, children were exposed to that. It's not nice when you're 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 year old or teenager even, and see your mother beaten black and blue and having to help your mother back to the makeshift hospital to try to get some bandages applied. And that happened. And I saw these things. So I avoided that. There were people who were taken out of the camp, and they were tortured. How often that happened, I don't know. I don't think it was all that often, but it was horrendous. And that would happen quite simply if a woman with looking after children would go to the fence and try to trade her clothes for a bit of food or medicine. People were desperate and took risks in order to survive. And if they were caught, the punishment could be absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, I could imagine. And of course, you were very young at the time. You write about after the camp, you had not known a normal life. You'd not known playing with kids out in the street, going to school, etc. The camp was really all you knew, if I'm correct. So how did that affect you when you started your life after the war?
Well, we stayed in the camp quite a long time after the war ended. So there was a distinction. The war ended on the 15th of August, and I left the camp, I think, about the middle of October when my dad turned up.
That was for your own safety, right? Just or not?
No. My mom was desperate to get out of the camp because of the overcrowding. So we took a risk by leaving the camp at that stage. We left the camp 2-3 months after the war ended and took a risk, but we were lucky, and we escaped from Java, literally escaped in a plane. We bummed a ride to Singapore, and so from that moment onwards, once we got on that airplane, DC-3 equipped for cargo carrying, and we managed to get a ride on that plane with about a dozen other people. And from that moment onwards, I had come out of a camp, and I had become suddenly a world traveler, which is quite astonishing. So I saw Singapore, and suddenly I got cornflakes for breakfast and Jell-O for dinner after dinner, and a hamburger, and it's all great stuff. And then we made this boat journey. So for about...
And sorry, just to get back to what were you eating in the camp?
Rice.
Dry rice.
Just rice, and we had there was some sort of a sago porridge was made. When we had brown beans, that was a luxury, that was exceptional. meat was non-existent. Fruit was also very rare. Our diet was almost entirely of rice. And cassava, ground up cassava.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you, you're on the plane to Europe. But I just wanted to make the contrast between the cornflakes and the Jell-O and what you had been eating in the camp.
For years after the war, I could not stand the idea of eating boiled rice. Okay, that's how bad it was. So we traveled for through the Red Cross, and my father was lucky and we were able to get some money. So that was all very exciting, you know. You're 7 year old. You've been in this strange cocoon of the camp, and now all of a sudden you're in the open world, you're traveling across the ocean and across Africa. But that was all nice. Where things bothered me was in South Africa. I suddenly, my parents, I was nearly 8 years old, my parents said, "Boudi, you must go to school." So I started off in kindergarten as an 8 year old with 4 year olds and 5 year olds. That was fine. I managed kindergarten quite well. I spent about a month in it. And then they put me into what was then called grade one of a primary school. And that's where problems started for me, because I suddenly now came in contact with children quite a bit closer to my age, but they could do things that were absolutely remarkable. They could ride a bike. They could catch a ball. They could throw a ball. I had no idea how to catch or throw a ball or ride a bike. And went on from that. And from that moment on, I was now in my eighth year, I had been used to playing with girls because we were mainly a female society that I grew up in. You know, in the primary school, the boys went off to one part of the field and I stayed there. I didn't dare to join them because of the threat of humiliation and my ineptitude. I knew nothing. I tell you, it was so bad that for my eighth birthday, my father had a job then. He bought me a bicycle. And I thought, in my naivety, it was just a two-wheeled bike. I said, "Well, you just get on the bike and you can ride a bike." Well, you can't. You have to learn to ride a bike. I had to understand what it meant to learn. So what it does, it...
So all the social skills and all the currency in a children's environment, you did not possess.
No, I've done that. I missed that completely.
And of course, we know how children can be, but also they probably would not have understood why you were not capable of throwing a ball or riding a bike.
He's stupid. That boy is stupid. He can't even catch a ball. You know, you throw a ball at him and he holds his hands 2 feet apart and the ball falls between his hands. I mean, how silly can you be? So you become very acutely aware of that. And here is the crux of the matter, is that for me, the only memory I had was of the camp. Yeah, that was my if you ask.
Well, that had been your life, right?
Yeah.
Your whole life.
My life was the camp. For my parents, it was quite different because they saw the camp as something strange, something absolutely abnormal. So throughout the camp, they said, "This is crazy." I didn't think it's crazy. I think it's normal. For me, the camp was absolutely normal. And after the war, my parents said to themselves, "You will go back to South Africa." And we left it 5 years earlier. And my parents said, my mom would say, "I wonder if the dog still remembers me." We'd given the dog to friends. Would the dog remember me? And probably did. And my parents knew the friends they'd go to see, the life they'd lead. And they, for them, the war was an aberration. For me, that was all brand new. My parents were not psychologists. They were good parents, but not psychologists. They had no idea how twisted and brainwashed my mind was as a result of the internment period. So they had no idea what went on in my mind. And we began to live separate lives. My parents regaining the life they knew from before the war, and me starting something completely new. You might have sent me to the moon.
And that's an experience you went through, but we'll get to that, I suppose, with all the other kids that that live in the camp, thousands. I don't know if you know approximate numbers. But before we go there, your father and your mother and you had been separated. Like, you lived with your mother, and your father was in a different camp, so you had not seen him. Did you even know him?
No.
Can you talk briefly about the reunion, and then maybe we can move on to the book you wrote after your father passed away?
Yeah. As the war neared its end, after we discovered that war had ended, which was about the 23rd of August, then people started to, children around me started talking about their dads. Yeah. There were 13-year-old, 14-year-old girls around me, and they all talked about dads. So I knew there was a thing called a dad. The only men I'd seen were the Japanese soldiers, and there were one or two doctors in the camp. So all these people talk about dads, and my mom started to talk to me about my dad and show me a picture. She said, "That's your dad." I didn't really know what it meant. And then one day, my father took his life in his hands when he boarded a train in Bandung. He had no tickets, no money, and basically a revolution had started, and he ended up in Jakarta and found us and turned up in the camp and asked, he said, "I'm looking for Mrs. Van Oort." And someone said, "Well, try that house." So he came to this house, and some woman at the front, there were about 110 people in that house, and the woman said, shouted the name to my mom. She said, "Willy, your husband's here." My mother was called Willy, Wilhelmina. I then knew enough about life that I said, "Oh, there's a thing called a dad, and that might be my dad. And it's like a possession, like something you have. If someone said your dog's just turned up, it's about the same reaction." Eh? So I ran, and I saw this guy standing in the yard in a pathetic lawn to be had, and he looked like a tramp, torn shirt, beaten up face, and I assumed that was my dad. I didn't recognize him. I had no idea what he looked like, and he didn't have a clue what I looked like. So I walked up to him and said, "Are you my dad?" And he said, "Are you my son?" And I said, "Well, my name is Baudi," and that was his name too. So that confirmed it, you know, we established identity, but it was a formal, a strange formal arrangement. We could shake hands. Yeah, I shake hands with dad and took him to my mom. And after that, I lost interest in the man because my father was very keen to talk to my mom and talk about all the things. Eh? They had a lot to share. And this is all above my head. I had no idea what this is all about. So that encounter was very, very strange. And my father never knew what had happened to me or how I'd grown up. I was a stranger to him, psychologically, even physically. He didn't recognize me.
Of course, he'd last seen you when you were 3 years old, and now you were seven.
Yeah. So that was a very emotional, for my dad, an extremely emotional encounter. And I didn't have a clue what's going on.
So how did that, did you develop a relationship with your dad eventually? How did that play out?
Never on the emotional plane. My father was beset by guilt for having gotten his family in this position because it was done voluntarily.
And well, he moved to Indonesia voluntarily.
Yeah, going to Indonesia. I mean, that's just...
there's no way for him to know.
No idea what happened. We know what we leave behind when we immigrate. We have absolutely no idea what lies ahead of us. That's exactly the way it is.
Yeah.
So my father, I think, was beset by guilt, and I found him interesting. He had a lot of things to say. I liked when he started to explain things to me about all sorts of stuff. You know, we went basically on a world cruise, if you like, And it was all brand new for me. So he told to me about boats and about planes and about South Africa and about the ocean and maps and all sorts of stuff. I was like a sponge soaking up all the knowledge he had imparted. And my father had him, in his camp experience, he had learned a lot himself because there were very intelligent people locked up with him, people who amused themselves by giving lectures. So my father started to talk to me about geology, for crying out loud, and about the other things that people had cleverly improvised in the camp. And I found this fascinating. The man was, for me, a fount of knowledge. He managed to get some money from Holland. He had a bank account in Holland, and he was able to squeeze some money out of the Dutch government when we arrived in Cairo. So I got sick there. We were refugees, and we actually went sightseeing in Cairo. Can you believe it? 2 months earlier, we were in a prison camp, and now we're sightseeing. Went to see the pyramids along the Nile.
Wow. Yeah. Huge impressions you're getting there. Now, of course, what we're talking about is, and one of the things you wrote your article in the Anthropological Journal is about the traumatic consequences of that war. And you're on your way to the Netherlands. Eventually, you go to Canada. What can you tell me about the trauma, how that affects not necessarily just yourself, but all those people who were children in the camps?
Well, one thing that hung over my head, there were two things that really, three things about it. First of all, I had developed an abhorrence of violence. I'd seen violence in front of my eyes, people being beaten up. I had enduring nightmares about the train journey, a horrible train journey, and that haunted me for years and years afterwards in my sleep. And I was also haunted by the specter of turning 10 years old. I did eventually become,
Why were you afraid of turning 10?
Because I'd be taken away from my mother. As soon as you, after your 10th birthday, the Japanese would load you in a truck and send you out of the camp gates, and nobody knew where these boys went. I saw them leave. So that scared the hell out of me.
And you had not realized at that point that this was something that would not happen to you. Because that's what you knew. You knew from the camp, you turned 10, you got taken away from your mom. You also mentioned in your article about something about you burst out crying when you saw the Dumbo, the Disney Dumbo movie.
Oh, yes. That was part of the manifestation. In Singapore, my mom gave me some a shilling and said, go to the movie house. I want to spend some time with your dad. So I went to the movie house with another little boy, and it was the Dumbo film. And at some stage, Dumbo his mother gets locked up, and Dumbo's left by himself. And I came out of the movie, I was crying. It still affects me.
So you're still worried that when you turn 10, you get taken away, you don't know where you're going because no one knew. That's a big thing hanging over your head there.
Yeah. In South Africa, my parents forgot to tell me, my dad forgot to put me on his knee and say, Paulie, you have this horrible thing. I understand that you're scared of turning 10 years old, but rest assured, that's not going to happen to you anymore. So he forgot to tell me that. So,
well, why would he, right? Because you wouldn't think of that as an adult. So
no, he did not know. Yeah. And so even my 10th birthday, which I didn't have many birthday parties, was a very strange party. And I was not really sure I wanted a 10th birthday. You're in this funny world. You're not quite sure what the hell, whether you're up or down, whether you're this or that. And psychologically,
and you come to an interesting subject here, because that's something you cover in your article that you wrote for that journal. You found out later, and we'll talk about that, that you were diagnosed with PTSD when you were 80, like after you lived a long life already. And one of the questions that's posed is, does the trauma come from the actual experiences in the camp, or does the trauma come from the experience of adapting to normal life post-camp?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think psychologically speaking, we are a bundle of memories. So if you have supposedly good events piled on top of bad memories, those good events get colored by the bad memories, if you see what I mean. In my case, I went to school. It's initially an indifferent scholar, but I could learn. And in the classroom, I felt secure. You know, you have your little desk, and you do as you're told by the teacher, and all the other children do the same thing, and that was fine. For me, the big problem was the social side, on the playground. On the playground, and that's from the very first day I went to school, I isolated myself on the playground. I would have nothing to do with these other children, and so I led this strange double life. I had a good, normal family life. But when we left South Africa, I left South Africa when I was 13 years old to go to Canada. I had no friends to say goodbye to. I was friendless. And when you are in that position, when you are do not know how to behave socially, and you come in a new environment, you are prone to become victims of other misfits. And I, in fact, became a victim of a misfit in Edmonton. A boy befriended me, and he had serious psychological problems, and he ended up in jail for armed robbery with violence. I was fortunate to escape from that relationship. I had no idea how to deal with friendships. You know, as an adult, you've learned some tricks, but as a child, I was inept. I had no idea.
So your life develops. You are you're a Rhodes Scholar. You go to Oxford. You study there. I would say that's atypical for children who've survived the camps, and I think you allude to that in your article as well. Most camp survivors had a very strange life, sad life in many cases. You have that distinction between your professional life, where you're very successful, but your personal life, that's a struggle. And almost like the schoolyard and the classroom dichotomy. How do you look at that? What set you apart? What can you tell us maybe about the experiences of your compatriots, your people who also went through it? What's your take on that?
Well, I was lucky. I was lucky when I went to high school to go to a rather academically inclined high school with no sporting facilities worth speaking of. So I just focused on my academic learning, my abilities. Going to Oxford was a revelation. I can come back to that later. But talking about my other children, first of all, I think a distinction needs to be drawn between the boys who shared my camp experience and the girls. Now, I do not know much about the girls' experience. I know they suffered. But the boys seem to be in a case apart, and I think it was partly because of this this threat of being removed from your mother and having to cope by yourself. So remarkably, in the small circle of friends that we built up in Bandung before the war were two families. One family had a boy and a girl, and they lived on the plantation, and they were old family friends from going back to Holland. The other was a family that we knew relatives in South Africa, and they had two boys. So I'm talking about three boys and a girl, aside from myself. I've got photos of these kids. The girl seemed to have ended up all right. She's now living in San Francisco and seems to be happily married, won't talk much about the past. Her brother, I can only describe as an unmitigated disaster. Sad, sad, sad story. He died in Holland. and never had anything remotely resembling normal life. That's one family. The other family, two boys. I went to visit one of these boys because I've become somewhat interested in the past. I went to visit one of these boys in Edmonton, and he had at that stage left a marriage, was obviously in dire straits, had become an alcoholic, and died as a pauper and a recluse on the West Coast, leaving a wife behind with some kids. She could not cope with him, and he had just given up. And his brother managed to, I have no idea whether they ever had kids. He didn't get married, but, and I had a lot of conversations with his family, but it was always indirect. I was always talking to his wife and not to him himself. And that family was beset by grief and misery. And both he and his brother had taken distance from their younger, much younger sister. So the siblings had broken up completely. So that's people I knew before the war. Four kids, three basically a disaster, and one managed to somehow repair a life. I wrote a book, and even as I was researching the book, I noticed, I came to in contact with some people, my generation, and there seemed to be an awful lot of misery there amongst the men. I didn't notice much about the, amongst the women. Here in Victoria, I researched the book, and there were a small group of people who had shared my experience. So we tossed around ideas. And I ran into four men, my age, my generation, gone through the same thing. One of these committed suicide and made some name for himself in the local paper because he had been well-liked in his community, lived like a recluse on his own. Obviously, never got his act together. The other one had managed to marry, but helped me with my book, contributed the story to my book. But by the time it was time for my book launch, he refused to have anything to do with the outside world. He had locked himself up with his wife, and his wife was having trouble coping with this guy. The other person did quite well academically, but again, had not really integrated into social life here, and upon retirement was a bit of a lost soul, also living by his wife, developed Alzheimer's, serious Alzheimer's, and he lived like almost like a recluse too. I had to go to his house and pick him up.
So Baudouin, how do you think the proportions are? Because and where do you place yourself on the spectrum? Because you did very well. You became an engineer. You write articles. You write books. You participate in podcasts. What sets you apart? And is there a lesson in that?
I was lucky. First of all, of course, going to Oxford was a huge stroke of luck because I was able to restart I redid my first university degree. I didn't. I had a second go at being a young person. In Oxford, I had 3 years to do as I pleased, to study what I wanted. And I then had become vaguely conscious of the fact that I was abnormal and tried to do something about it, only vaguely conscious. And so during Oxford, you could say, Bao, you're on your way to a successful life. Unfortunately, after my first year at Oxford, my mother died. And that basically undid or threw a monkey wrench in my psychological works. And I had never repaired my relationship with my dad. properly. So I was then an orphan.
You're on your own. You're an orphan all over again.
But I had enjoyed a good education in Ottawa at high school and university. And now I had this extra qualification of survived and done an interesting course. So academically, I was doing well. And I got myself into a job which was fascinating, and I was very successful at it, but I'd never cracked the social nut. So I was at the social level, I was miserable after my first year at Oxford. Oxford was a distraction, but once I went in the workforce, my antisocial past caught up with me. And I then was looking for a lifeboat, a psychological lifeboat in the form of a partner. And I had zero confidence in my own abilities to tell good from bad, placed extraordinary reliance on what I thought were the wise counsel of an older woman who herself had been childless, but had taken on a mothering role for me. I'd found, in fact, a substitute mother in her. She was my landlady. And so the marriage I ended up with was an arranged marriage. It was arranged by a woman who knew even less about the young woman she put me in touch with as she do about me. And we were like two lame ducks trying to get on in life, and it was a disaster. But you know, but I was good at my work. I left the house in the morning, did very well at work, and exciting work, and came back at night to deal with psychological shambles, and hung on for dear life to try to survive. It took a heavy toll of mine. My children suffered, of course. I can't help. So, yeah. As I said, you know, at school, from the get-go, I could learn. I could learn new stuff. I could learn how to read and write.
So, you talk about the social social toll and the psychological toll it had on you in your personal life. Now, fast forward many, many years. The Dutch government in the 1990s started talking about giving compensation to survivors of the camp. Why it took so long is a long story, and I don't think we really have time to go into that, maybe some other time. But at that point, you had to undergo a psychological examination to see if you were eligible for that compensation. Is that right?
Yes and no. I approached the Dutch government from a point of ignorance, because we had severed our relationship with Holland years ago. So I approached from ignorance, and I thought I was asking for compensation for spending the wartime in prison camp. And that was not quite what the Act said, what the rules were. The issue was that the Dutch government had realized that there was a lot of psychological distress left over from the war, and that these people were in serious trouble, in Holland particularly, and had made an enactment that allowed them to now find financial help in dealing with the medical problems. So I applied for what, in my idea, was a sort of a pension. But the Dutch government said, no, Mr. Van Oort, we are going to see if your life indeed has merits, support to help you with your medical problems. And I was doing fine. I was living, I'd remarried, I was living quite happily in a very nice place. So I had misconceptions, but the ball got rolling and I was interviewed by a psychologist, and he asked me all sorts of questions. I had no idea why, because I knew nothing about the legislation. And then I suddenly get this letter from the Dutch government, and the Dutch government said, Mr. Van Oort, you have been affected by the war. The Dutch word is oorlogsgetroffen. We recognize that you have suffered from PTSD, but it was past It was history. It has history. I had remarried in 1990 and gradually dug myself out of the crazy mess I was in. And so I was living a good life, and I'd always had a good job. So that was really odd. But what it did was it suddenly woke me up to the fact that all the crap that had happened in the past to me had an explanation. I could suddenly start seeing cause and effect. And said, how the hell did I? At one stage, you're a Rhodes Scholar, you go to Oxford, the world shines on you, and the next moment, you're in the depths of despair. How did that happen?
And so you were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, but the government said, yeah, but you've kind of gotten over that.
But they said, if you're in trouble in the future, don't hesitate to contact us.
Okay.
So I'm on the list. If I tomorrow need psychiatric treatment and it's going to cost money, I can write to the Dutch government and presumably they'll pay for some of the costs.
But it wasn't until you were actually 80 that you realized for yourself, okay, yeah. There is, you know, there's a term for that, a term you probably knew, but you'd never associated with your own life.
What you do is you mentally shut off the bad bits of the past. I didn't want to think about it. Too much bad things had happened. I didn't want to know.
Wow, yeah. So we're getting towards the end, Boudewijn, but I did want to ask you one more thing. And that's in the article I read, you draw a parallel with the Canadian residential school system and the trauma that students that went to those schools suffered. Can you briefly talk about that? Where did that come from?
Well, just the last few years, the residential school system has become a cause célèbre here. We hear about it almost every day, particularly in British Columbia. And I started looking into it, and I realized that what those Indian children went through was very similar to what I went through. You know, your course of life is interrupted in a crazy way. I was put in a prison camp. My father sent away to God knows where. All sorts of strange things happened. And afterwards, I emerged from the camp and I'm told, not literally, but I'm told, pal, you're back in normal life. Get your act together. I had no idea how to do that because I had been stamped by the war years. We humans are just accumulation of memories. It's very hard to erase the past. It's part of you. So it's a major problem to try to compensate for the bad things that you encountered in the past and that haunt you.
Well, you can't turn the clock back. It's happened to you. And it's become part of you. Wow, that's fascinating. That was great. Thank you so much, Boudewijn, for joining me on Dutch the Podcast. There's so many more things to explore. I would suggest people may want to look at your book and other articles you're writing. Is there anything else you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, I've got two things on the go. One, I'm writing some articles for the Dutch paper about the sea, but that really is interrupting an attempt I've been making to describe in detail how my life went off the rails as a result of the war. So this is an autobiography, but it explores the psychological issues that occurred during that period of time. This is difficult to do. It's difficult to find the words. It's, of course, it's in a way it's painful, but it's also difficult to find the words to convey the idea to an adult reader. It's not for children. People have asked me, well, tell my children how the war affected you. No, I'd rather not. This is too profound. But I imagine an adult would have to read a story about how a child developed thinking as a child. How did the child think? What went on in my mind as a 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 year old? and try to convey it and make that readable. I don't think that it's a difficult task.
But we'll look out for it, and we'll definitely, through the Dutch paper and Dutch the magazine, keep people apprised of your progress. And if something comes out of it, because I'm sure many people listening to this would be interested to read it. Thank you again so much, Boudewijn, and I wish you all the best with your ongoing endeavors.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's good talk to you.
Thanks.
Tom, as always, you bring these fascinating stories with a Dutch vein straight to the heart. As you mentioned before the interview, starting your life at an internment camp, if that's the beginning normal that you remember, the rest of your life is going to be affected by that.
And very significantly. And Boudewijn can talk about it, and he did well, much better than a lot of his friends that went through that experience, as we heard from him. So I really appreciate him taking the time to talk to us about it.
Another great interview leads me to this discussion, if you don't mind, Tom. Every month, incredible stories that reach into history and culture and life and food and every aspect of tourism and every aspect of Dutch life through the eyes of expatriate folks from the Netherlands, just like you, potentially. And so I'll recommend that you go to DutchTheMedia.com and check out the brand new, fully digital and 100% accessible to anybody in the world version of that magazine. Tom, tell us a bit more about what we'll find in this month's magazine.
Yeah, we've got some amazing stories in this month's magazine again. As always, we visit the place. We have some cooking features. And we're talking to people of Dutch descent. You know, there's only a handful of football players that have played in both the Grey Cup and the Super Bowl. And one of them was a Dutchman called Harold Hasselbeck. Used to play in Calgary.
Of course.
And he is the only Dutchman to ever win a Super Bowl. So we look at his life. Sadly, he passed away recently, but we look back on his life. So that's one example of the content in this month's magazine.
And as I point out, now it's a digital version. You don't have to wait for it to come in the mail. And of course, it's great for the environment. You can take it with you anywhere you want. Dutch the Magazine at DutchTheMedia.com. All kinds of amazing books and other publications that you can get for the Dutch community right there.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, Mike. Thanks for raising that. Check out the books tab when you're on the website. You know, some really cool books about the Dutch in North America and the Dutch in general.
Well, there you go. And also, we would encourage you to reach out to us. You can get in touch with your questions or any feedback you have, DutchTheMedia.com, and we would love to hear from you. Tom, another great episode. Please tell your friends to subscribe. Not you, Tom. I'm sure you already do that.
I've told all my friends, Mike.
You already told me, and I subscribed. But thank you very much for being with us. We'll do it again shortly. Tom, thanks so much. Great show.
Thanks, Mike. See you later.